Thank you very much for the introduction. As you mentioned, my name is Erin Donnelly, and I'm a master's student in the School of Forest Resources and the Evans School of Public Affairs. And today I'm going to be speaking about strategic planning for water rights acquisitions in the Columbia Basin using an assessment of regional stream flow response to climate change. So I'm going to begin by identifying the geographic region that I'm focusing on for my research, identifying the most important driving factors for this research, and identifying need for research in this area. I'm then going to describe my research objectives and methods and share with you my preliminary results and conclusions. Now, this is a map of the Columbia River Basin. The Columbia River has a 2,000-kilometer extent beginning in British Columbia and emptying into the Pacific Ocean at Astoria, Oregon. And cumulative human impacts in the Columbia Basin over the last century have substantially changed the natural flow regime of the Columbia River. In particular, imposition of hydroelectric dams and diversions for irrigated agriculture have changed the annual hydrograph. As you can see, there are more than 20 large dams colored in red along both the Columbia and Snake Rivers. As a result of these cumulative human impacts, both population size and diversity of salmon populations have been substantially reduced. Currently, 12 evolutionarily significant units, or ESUs, of salmon are listed as either threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Which leads me to my first driving factor for my research, the impact of low stream flows on salmon populations. Why are low stream flows a problem? Well, first, low stream flows can change the thermal regime of the in-stream habitat, potentially increasing mortality rates for spawning adults. Second, low stream flows can desiccate salmon eggs, or in other words, dewater the reds. Third, low stream flows can have very important impacts on the physiological development of smolts. And finally, low stream flows can extend the migration time of smolts as they head towards the ocean, potentially reducing their overall fitness. The second driving factor for my research is the emergence of market-based conservation approaches. While the Endangered Species Act has served as an important mandate for federal agencies to address endangered salmon populations, there are new approaches, including market-based approaches, which primarily include water rights acquisitions on a willing buyer, willing seller basis in order to conserve salmon habitat and reduce the impacts of low stream flows on struggling salmon. Organizations like the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, in concert with the Washington Water Trust, are working through the Columbia Basin Water Transaction Program in order to reduce the impacts of low flows on struggling salmon. While these organizations have existing strategic approaches, they currently do not consider the impacts of climate change on their work. This leads me to my final driving factor for my research, the uncertain hydrologic future resulting from climate change. Last year, the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group released their Washington Climate Change Assessment, in which they indicate that in the future, Washington State can expect to see lower spring snow water equivalents, changes in the timing of stream discharge, and also changes in the seasonality of stream discharge. And while these findings have proven extremely important for managers and water resource planners on a statewide basis, it's equally important for managers and planners to assess the effects of climate change on hydrology at smaller scales of resolution, including the sub-basin basis or even the reach scale. Only one published study, which is also part of the Washington Climate Change Assessment, currently assesses the potential effects of climate change on stream flow at the sub-basin level. That study has served as the foundation for my research, in which I examine potential effects of climate change on stream flow in four separate sub-basins and provide a comparison of those changes. My research objectives include providing a comprehensive understanding of the projected changes in projected climate-induced changes in hydrology in selected sub-basins, including ranking the sub-basins from most to least likely to experience changes in hydrology in the future. My second objective is to create a strategic plan for water rights acquisitions in areas that may be most flow-limited in the next 30 years. And my third objective is to facilitate organizations like the Washington Department of Ecology and the Washington Water Trust as they use the strategic plan in an applied setting. My research methods are based on a strategic planning template. A strategic plan has two primary components, including an external assessment and an internal organizational assessment. Once an organization has completed these two assessments, they can decide on a strategic direction, define a plan, implement that plan, and assess the performance of that plan over time through performance evaluations. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to be focusing on the external environmental assessment, while in my larger research, I'm also performing an internal organizational assessment. So the external environmental assessment has two primary components. The first is GIS-based sub-basin selection, and the second is a simulation of future and historic managed stream flows. The sub-basin selection criteria that I used in my GIS analysis include whether or not a basin has listed evolutionarily significant units, or ESUs, of salmon, high water use for irrigation, and high potential for future hydrologic change. I'd like to draw your attention to the map on the left. The pink crosshatched area represents geographic regions that satisfy the first two selection criteria. They have listed ESUs of salmon and high water use for irrigation. On the right, I show basins that are either rain dominant, represented by the color green, transitional, represented by the color orange, or snow dominant, represented by the color blue. And I'm most interested in the areas that are snow dominant because, as the Climate Impacts Group indicated, we're going to be seeing lower snow water equivalents during the spring, and this will have the greatest impact on hydrology. So what you see here on the map on the left is an overlap of the first two selection criteria with potential change in hydrology. And the areas that have the greatest overlap include the Okanagan subbasin, the Metau, the Wenatchee, and the Yakima subbasin. The second portion of my external assessment includes a simulation of historic and future managed stream flow. This has two parts. In the first section, I received data from the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group, in which they provided global climate models and hydrologic simulations. And I used this data as inputs for my water evaluation and planning system, which is a water resource management model. The ultimate outcome of this multi-model simulation is future and historic managed stream flow. The planning scenarios that I'm using in my water evaluation and planning model include a pairing of four management scenarios with two carbon dioxide emission scenarios over two time periods. And as you can see, I have them listed as A1B and B1 for both time periods. A1B is a carbon dioxide emission scenario identified by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as a relatively high carbon dioxide emission scenario. Some people may say it's a little bit conservative, but for this purpose, we're using it as the high emission scenario. B1 represents a relatively low carbon dioxide emission scenario and is generally considered a future including clean energy and greatly reduced carbon emissions. So the management scenarios include a 20% increase in agricultural water use, a 40% increase in agricultural water use, setting the existing in-stream flow rule as the first priority, and creating a biologically based flow rule, setting that as the first priority. And these last two management scenarios allow me to essentially perform a thought experiment in which I ask, how might out-of-stream water users be impacted if we gave fish the first cut in the allocation scheme? And second, how would out-of-stream water users be impacted if we not only gave them the first cut of the water, but we also gave them all the water that they biologically require for their physiological development and to sustain their populations? So what we're looking at here is a screenshot of my water evaluation and planning model. This is an up-close view of the Okanagan subbasin. And as you can see, I have a network of nodes here. I'm going to go through one by one and describe what these nodes mean. This is just the Okanagan, but each subbasin has a similar network of nodes. The first represents the reservoirs in the Okanagan basin. I'm able to simulate reservoir management. The second are diversions for agriculture, municipal and domestic demand, and commercial and industrial demand. I'm also able to simulate the return flows from these demands. Additionally, I'm able to include the existing in-stream flow rule set by the Department of Ecology, and I also include observed stream flow data from the U.S. Geological Survey in order to calibrate my model. So I'm going to transition to my preliminary results, and I realize this is a lot to take in at once, but I'm going to walk you through what we're looking at here, and I'm going to show you which areas I'd like you to focus on in this figure. What we're looking at is average monthly stream discharge for the Okanagan subbasin using the climate-only scenario. And on the x-axis, we have months of the year, on the left beginning in January and on the right ending in December. And on the y-axis, we have average monthly discharge in cubic feet per second. And I'm going to identify the colors that are associated with each month. Blue represents the 2020 A1B scenario, which again is the relatively high carbon dioxide emission scenario. Red represents the 2020 B1 scenario. Green represents 2040 A1B and 2040, and yellow represents 2040 B1. Gray represents the historical scenario. And I've created average monthly discharge figures just like this one for all four subbasins, but for the sake of brevity, I'm just going to show you a couple of these graphs and then provide you with a summary table at the end. So what I would like you to focus on in this figure are the summer months, including July, August, and September, in which these basins are most likely to experience low flow conditions. And in the following figure, I'm just going to provide this portion of the annual discharge graph. So again, we're looking at average monthly stream flow in cubic feet per second relative to the flow-limited summer months. And this time we're looking at the Wenatchee subbasin for the climate-only scenario. For the 2020 A1B scenario, we see an average of a 25% reduction in average monthly discharge relative to historic conditions. For the 2020 B1 scenario, we see an average of 28% reduction in average monthly stream flow relative to historic conditions. For 2040 A1B, we see a 42% reduction, and 2040 B1, we see a 46% reduction in average monthly stream flow relative to the historical conditions. And I'll ask you for a moment to pay particular attention to the month of September. While a change of only 250 CFS really may not seem like very much of a change in the grand scheme of things, but if we contextualize this change in terms of the biological flow needs for salmon, this represents half of the flow that would have been available under historic conditions. And a change of this magnitude may very well have disastrous implications for endangered salmon that are currently struggling under existing flow conditions. So this is the summary table of all four subbasins under all four climate scenarios. And as I mentioned in the previous figure, the Wenatchee subbasin experiences the greatest percent reduction in average monthly stream flow under all climate scenarios. And this may be due to a few possible different things. In comparison to the Okanagan subbasin, the Wenatchee subbasin has a much higher degree of snowpack dependence. And also a higher degree of withdrawals for agriculture. In comparison to the Methow, the Wenatchee is almost equally snow dominant, but it has a far greater rate of water withdrawals for irrigation. And while the Yakima subbasin has substantially more withdrawals for irrigation, it's not nearly as snowpack dependent. So the fact that the Wenatchee is high in both of those categories makes it the most vulnerable to climate change in the future. So my next step is to compare my simulated flows with salmonid life stage and species-specific flow duration curves. And this step is the most critical for being able to provide organizations who will be using this information with recommendations for which areas, which geographic regions, and habitat types will benefit the most from their work. This step also happens to be one of the most difficult portions, and if anybody in the audience here today is working on this, I would definitely appreciate having a conversation with you. Please feel free to contact me. So my preliminary conclusions, again, I'm only midway through this study, so my conclusions are rather broad in scope, but many salmonids in the Central Columbia Basin are in danger of extinction, and while traditional command and control regulations, such as the Endangered Species Act, have not significantly improved salmon population numbers, there are new market-based conservation approaches to in-stream flow conservation that really show great promise. And my study will result in strategic recommendations for future water rights acquisitions that can maximize the benefit of in-stream flow conservation. And before I finish, I'd like to share with you how my objectives, once they're completed, will actually be used. How will they be put to practice? And I'm going to start by giving you a short map of the political governance structure surrounding this situation. So as I mentioned early on in the talk, the Endangered Species Act serves as a mandate for federal agencies to address endangered salmon populations. And federal agencies, such as the Bonneville Power Administration, in combination with the Northwest Power and Planning Council, respond to this mandate by providing conservation funding for entities that can do mitigation work and restoration for these struggling salmon populations. Local agencies and organizations, such as the Department of Ecology and the Washington Water Trust, are recipients of these conservation funding dollars and use that money for water rights acquisitions in order to improve in-stream flow conditions. And the ultimate outcome of this funding chain are improved environmental outcomes for endangered salmon. Upon completion of my first objective, I will be able to recommend to local agencies and organizations which geographic regions and habitat types will benefit the most from their organizational activities. And my second and third objectives, which again include a strategic plan and facilitating the organizations who will use the plan, come into play at two points in the organizational structure. The first is the strategic plan can be used in order to demonstrate efficient use of conservation funding dollars between funding providers and funding recipients during performance reviews. And second, as I've previously mentioned, the strategic plan can be useful in maximizing environmental outcomes for endangered fish species. And on a final note, while these issues surrounding salmon conservation are extremely complex and climate change projections add additional layers of uncertainty, my project and projects like mine show that we have data and decision support tools available to us today that can help us make the best possible decisions and use limited funding wisely in order to support those conservation efforts that are showing the most progress. And with that, I have a number of people that I'd like to thank. My committee members, Dr. Robert Nyman, Joe Cook, and Josh Lawler, Susan Adams and Amanda Cronin of the Washington Water Trust, David Perkey and Vishal Mehta of the Stockholm Environment Institute, everyone at the Climate Impacts Group, including and especially Dr. Alan Hamlet, and Matthew Marino and Julie Vano of the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. Thank you very much. Yep.